Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, welcome to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Richard Aidy. Glad you could join me. We have one of the lowest rates of smoking in the world. It's well under 20% of the population now, which means those of us still doing it are hardcore. How can these smokers be persuaded to give up? Oh, and we've also got taboo words. I don't think I need to spell them out. That's a bit later. Indigenous child abuse is a national emergency. That's how the Prime Minister described it. And as you'll be aware, he's announced federal intervention into Indigenous communities in the Northern Territory. There'll be a ban on alcohol and pornography, compulsory health checks for Aboriginal children, more police, and a threat to stop welfare payments unless kids go to school and money spent on necessities like food. Linking government payments to child welfare echoes what we've been hearing from Indigenous leader Noel Pearson, the director of the Cape York Institute. He wants to use welfare as a catalyst for change, to rebuild social norms in remote communities. These ideas will be discussed further at the Strong Foundations Conference today and tomorrow. One of the speakers is Associate Professor Helen Milroy, an Indigenous child psychiatrist who joins me now from Cairns. Helen Milroy, your specialty is Indigenous child health. What do you make of the tough measures proposed by the federal government?
I think that it's very, very easy to put in a sanction like welfare payments and redirecting the money or whatever. I think those sorts of sanctions are very easy to put in. But what's very hard to put in place, because we know that these things are very much lacking already, is the infrastructure that actually supports parents. I mean, I don't think that you can just have these sorts of sanctions if you really don't have the infrastructure already in place that is actually going to assist families in getting back on track. I work with children, and I mean, I've worked with children and families my entire, you know, sort of medical life. And it's very, very difficult sometimes when you've got such major social problems to suddenly turn it all around in a short space of time. So unless you really have the support mechanisms already in place, already well thought out, and this isn't about the do-gooder industry either. I mean, I'm not interested in making families or children more dependent. You know, I always work with families about gaining independence, but you've got to have the right systems in place first. And if they're not in place first, then I'm concerned that if we start introducing sanctions and then we start fining parents for not being able to carry through, are we just going to end up putting them in jail?
Or just making things worse. Well, what kind of support then do Indigenous parents who are caught in perhaps a cycle of poverty and abuse, what kind of support do they need?
Well, a lot of the parents, I think, are dealing with major issues themselves from their own childhoods. I mean, we've certainly seen, you know, generations of abuse and trauma and loss in our communities. I think that families that are dealing in situations where a lot of people have high levels of disease as well as mental health problems, it's very difficult to actually cope with the levels of stress in communities. So unless you're dealing with actually reducing stress and putting in place, you know, mechanisms where families can actually get support and assistance and develop positive coping mechanisms, then I just don't think the sanctions would work at all.
If parents fail, it's usually grandmothers and other extended family who step in. But given the extent of the problem, they're already pretty stretched.
I think you have to really look at our population makeup to understand the difficulty for grandmothers. Our population distribution in terms of the ages is quite abnormal. We have an absolute mob of kids, which is fantastic because they are actually our future. We have not enough people in the middle-aged group who are essentially the parents. And then further up the tree, we have very, very, very few elders. And given the high levels of morbidity and mortality, we're expecting, you know, one grandmother really to cater for many, many families. If you compare that to the non-Indigenous population, you have less kids, heaps of adults and lots of old people. Totally different.
It is. It's almost inverted.
You can't apply the same sorts of rules or regulations or even support systems because you have a totally different population group.
Much of the child abuse and neglect is blamed on alcohol. How important do you think the ban on alcohol is as at least a circuit breaker?
I think alcohol is a major problem for our whole community, not just our Indigenous people. And I think that anything to do with alcohol should be considered very carefully in terms of, you know, the whole community. I also think that a ban for 6 months, I mean, what's that sort of really meant to do? Maybe a circuit breaker. Have you got detox facilities in all of the communities? Actually, drying out from alcohol can be medically quite dangerous and very tricky to treat. Some of the underlying causes that cause people to sort of drink alcohol or abuse other drugs, are they going to be dealt with? You know, what's the sort of other mechanisms that are going to be put in place to support people actually becoming dry or abstinent? I think just a blanket ban, I don't know.
The federal government wants Indigenous children to have a compulsory medical examination. This has already caused some controversy. Is that a good start to have a benchmark to work from?
I think it depends what it means by a compulsory medical examination. If we're just talking about developmental screening or whatever, then generally I would support that. I think that all children should have really good, healthy development that's actually checked from time to time. But if they're going to force children to submit to examinations without parental consent, I'd be extremely concerned, because that in itself could be somewhat traumatic, possibly even abusive. I guess if the Prime Minister wants to take leadership on compulsory health checks, maybe he could consider some compulsory health checks for the government. I mean, let's face it, would we like to know the cause of the impaired vision and poor hearing that the government have displayed over the last decade or so? And perhaps the psychiatric examination may also be warranted to look at the lack of insight and judgment that the government are also displaying.
On Life Matters today, our guest is Associate Professor Helen Milroy, who's Director of the Centre for Aboriginal Medical and Dental Health at the University of Western Australia. And she's speaking at the Strong Foundations Conference in Cairns today. Something I think you've already alluded to, Helen. How well equipped are remote communities in terms of a medical workforce to follow through with treatment?
Well, I don't think they have one. And that's one of the issues. I mean, I'm also part of the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association. I also run a centre at the University of Western Australia, and at the moment our centre supports and recruits and retains Indigenous medical students into medicine and into, you know, obviously into the sort of health workforce. We also are teaching a culturally competent sort of Aboriginal health curriculum so that we're getting a more culturally competent workforce. But it's really small gains. It's going to take us a long time to train enough doctors to go back into communities, and the actual health worker type workforce is also pretty thin on the ground as well. So how they roll out these initiatives, I'm really unclear.
A Darwin paediatrician, Paul Bowart, he's on Breakfast with Fran Kelly this morning. He said in The Age that while reports focus on sexual abuse, physical diseases and poor living conditions have a much greater impact on the health of Indigenous kids. What do you make of that view?
I think they both have a major impact. I know that physical health is always put up there, and I have no doubt that that needs to be fixed. I mean, let's face it, you're not going to have healthy adults if you've actually got babies born with low birth weights who then have failure to thrive, suffer from malnutrition, as well as all of the other sorts of childhood infectious diseases that they get, and impaired hearing and all of that sort of thing. And that just leads to, you know, a lifelong legacy of ill health. But the mental health side of it's got to be looked at as well. There's a lot of information, I think, internationally, really, about the impact of life stress events and chronic stress on child development. And in fact, a lot of the literature basically says that if you live a chronically stressful life as a child, then you'll grow up and you'll end up getting chronic disease such as diabetes, renal failure, and those sorts of things. So unless we actually tackle the stress side of things as well, we won't win the war just looking at physical health. We need to look at both, and we need to look at it very, very comprehensively.
Conditions in the remote communities have grabbed the headlines, but Indigenous people live in a variety of communities. Are there similar problems in urban centres?
Of course there are. In fact, if you look at some of the health statistics, there's not much difference.
Do we need different strategies?
You definitely need different strategies, because the potential for access to health services, and I say potential because it doesn't always occur, is better within urban communities. So you hopefully have a larger workforce that you can potentially use. But in some of the remote communities, particularly, say, places like Western Australia or the Northern Territory, even getting road access out to some communities is difficult. So the logistics and the geographical isolation and all of those sorts of things also play a major impact. There also are some protective factors about being in a remote community too, however. And certainly some of the data that we've got from the Western Australian Aboriginal Child Health Survey say that some of those remote communities are actually doing quite well on some things, even better sometimes than some of the urban communities.
You're speaking at the Strong Foundations conference today about early childhood. Indigenous children start school significantly disadvantaged. What will make the difference?
I'd really like to see a lot of emphasis placed on those early years. If you look at, say, the foundations of emotional regulation and behavioural control, even things like stimulation in that early childhood arena actually assist development right across all dimensions. Even good physical health or physical health in general will actually improve if there's good attachment and good stimulation as well as the appropriate sort of nurturing and facilities available in those early years. So I'd really like to see the emphasis there. If you wait till kids get to school, you're already behind the eight ball. So you've got to start with that really early childhood development stuff in those, you know, first 4 years of life. First 2 years, of course, around the mothering and the sort of emotional attachment and those sorts of things. But leading on from that, the play and learning side of it, for instance, play is actually an incredibly important tool for children. And I really wonder whether some of our kids in our communities even have the freedom to play.
So preschool programs, is that what we're looking at?
I'm not suggesting that children should be having an additional year of preschool, but some of the early sort of child support type programs could be developed that would actually assist families in being able to know what to do for their kids and how to do it and engage back in that sort of those early years like we would have done years ago.
Helen, you mentioned earlier the Indigenous Doctors Association. I think you're the past president of it, immediate past president. The association says that federal interventions rushed and without Indigenous consultation. If Indigenous communities lose control of the process, and really at the moment it does look as if that's what's going to happen, how effective will these measures be?
If we really want healthy parents and healthy kids for the future, and I really hope that that's what Australia wants, because it's certainly what I want, then we've got to also look at how we get parents and communities empowered to take control. I don't think that you could talk... I'm sure if you spoke to every Indigenous person in Australia, they would want exactly the same thing as everybody else. Healthy, happy children that are going to grow up well and be functional adults. No one wants this state of despair. So rather than being too authoritarian or imposing things, how do we really harness the community to recover, to be functional again in the future? If we take away all control, aren't we just making them dependent?
I think you are an optimist.
I am.
But I sense that you have concerns about the detail of this package.
I do. And having worked with, for many years, as I said, with children and families who have come from incredibly traumatic situation, and I deal in psychiatry, so I do deal with the sort of worst end of the spectrum from some respects. I really do see the impact of trauma and loss and grief on our communities that really prevents people from getting ahead. And I see those cycles just being repeated. And I don't have the answers, but I just think we need to be cautious that we don't make things worse and that we don't go for a short-term gain, which looks like, oh, yes, we've now got control. But if you take away people's control, what are you really doing to them in the long term, and what's the message you're giving the kids?
Helen, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Associate Professor Helen Milroy, Director of the Centre for Aboriginal Medical and Dental Health, is at the University of Western Australia, and she's speaking today at the Strong Foundations Conference in Cairns. And we'll have more from that conference in Cairns tomorrow on Life Matters, this time looking at the key to breaking down generational welfare dependence. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Richard Ady. Coming up next, hardcore smoking, what it will take to get those remaining Australians who still smoke to give the ciggies away.
E con dia bota volta pa voluta.
Today in the Daily Planet, the unmistakable sound of the Barefoot Diva from Cape Verde Islands. That's Cesaria Evora from her new album Rogamar. It means pray to the sea or praise the sea. Wonderful new music uniting Portugal, Cape Verde and Brazil. That's all ahead in the Daily Planet today, 2:20 this afternoon and 11:20 this evening with me, Brent Clough, here on ABC Radio National.
Like me, you might remember the pall of smoke that used to hang over offices and workplaces in Australia, a result of people lighting up and puffing away. It's now been several years since smoking in most Australian workplaces has been banned, depending on which state you live in. So it might surprise you to learn that the UK is only this week about to outlaw smoking in the workplace. In one fell swoop, smoking will also be banned in pubs, restaurants and private clubs from July the 1st. In anticipation of the ban, the UK has been looking to Australia, where pretty much best practice when it comes to reducing smoking. And joining me in the studio is Renee Bretoun, Australia's first ever recently appointed Professor of Tobacco Cessation at the University of Sydney. Renee's just returned from an international conference in London where she's been telling the Brits a few things about our successes here. Welcome back to Life Matters, Renee.
Good morning.
We've clearly got a head start on countries like Britain when it comes to smoking in public. How has that had an impact on our smoking rates?
Well, what I think was happening in Australia, of course, our prevalence rates are now somewhere in the order of globally 17%. Globally meaning the prevalence is between the ages of 18 and 65, say. In that age group, if you look at the mean, it's about 17%. It's a little higher in the younger and a lot lower in the older. So it's a bit of an age-related phenomenon. The younger you are, the more likely you are to be a smoker still today. The older, obviously, there's peer group pressure to not smoke as you age. So that's in Australia. And in the UK, it's quite considerably higher than that.
How much higher?
Well, probably another 10% higher in the UK. So we can predict that that's probably what's going to happen with pressures of the workplace becoming non-smoking. People are going to opt out of it.
I remember going back to visit the UK a couple of years ago and landing at Heathrow with young children and being appalled that people were smoking, admittedly in specific areas, but of course the smoke was going everywhere. And I had forgotten this about the UK.
Well, it's not just the UK, in a lot of Europe, you know, you'll have your bank teller still smoking and people taking, you know, in various Commonwealth or governmental offices still smoking behind counters. But as I said, that's going.
How ready are they to implement this change?
They're nervous about it. They're not that they're predicting revolution, but that's... We always were a little nervous, and I recall, in fact, at the ABC years ago doing talkback radio and people going, oh, you know, civil liberties, how can you do this, you health fascists, etc. And that we certainly gave them the impression this last week when I was in the UK that it really doesn't last very long, that in about a day or so, people are really quite amenable to it. They see the huge advantages to no smoking in the workplace. Huge advantages.
Have they done the work on the ground? They've got sort of the campaign. I suppose they've started the campaign already, but are they doing things like giving priority to certain areas, that kind of thing?
They certainly have. They've done things like they have, like we do here in Australia, a very formidable quit line so people can call, and they've advertised that. They also, unlike here, have smokers' clinics in just about every major teaching hospital in the UK. And people can spontaneously just turn up. You don't need a referral. You could just go along, get help face-to-face with a counsellor, which is really something quite impressive.
Now, you presented a paper at the conference in London, which you were barely in London. You only really had time to get off the plane and then go back to Heathrow, I understand. But I understand they were pretty impressed with the paper you gave.
What we talked about was how intensively we can treat some smokers today. I guess there is a bit of a dilemma here because on the one hand, there are many smokers who do quit spontaneously. That is, they decide, they see the ads or they see the workplace ban, can't do it at work anymore, gosh, I think I've had enough of this, I'm going to stop. There are people who just do that. And then, of course, on the other end of the spectrum, there are people who just can't do that, who are standing outside in the cold and the rain and still doing it. And it's that group of people who we are now tackling with. And I presented on that hardcore group who are hard to treat, who you need to help with quite intensively. They are somewhat resistant. I don't mean resistant, they don't want to do anything about it. They do. They just can't. They find it incredibly difficult to do anything about this. and it's how you treat them. And basically, I suggested that you bombard them with pharmacotherapies, treatments, the medications. Take it. Yes, do take a tablet if you need to help you not smoke. It does work. It's better than doing nothing.
I think last time you were on the show, we talked about one of the things we talked about was the number of times it can take some people. 11 is the number I'm remembering, is that?
No, it's less than that. It's about four and a half times. 11 sounds a lot.
It does.
Well, you would have people who certainly have multiple attempts. It is about four is the average. But some are suggesting, why do you even need to go to four times? On the one hand, some groups are saying, well, four times you sort of have to practice to quit. It gets quite traumatic after the third time. You know, here you are again.
You kind of wonder if you can.
Not doing terribly well, that's right. And people are saying, well, maybe we could just hit them hard the first time. A bit like having an infection and treating it with an antibiotic. Do we have to go through three or four types of antibiotics before we actually get to the cure?
We are in a different stage here, because in the UK they've still been very much focused on smoking as a public health problem. And we've really moved beyond that, haven't we?
Well, I believe so. Obviously, the public health initiatives are huge and have had enormous impacts in Australia. And I see it as somewhat of a pyramid, where they're the bottom of the pyramid, huge surface area, large groups of people have quit smoking. And eventually, I think we need to look more at individualising treatments, very much like any medical problem. There are medical problems that can't be treated universally, that there is no one-size-fits-all for some of those people who have a real specific problem. There are what are called comorbidities. They have other things going on as well, like they might have a psychiatric comorbidity or using other substances or other medical problems, so that they get very distressed by that. Classically, what I see is a lot of patients with respiratory problems from their smoking, which makes them very depressed, which makes them smoke more, which makes their respiratory problem worse. So it keeps going round and round in circles.
Yeah.
So these people need really a bit of tender, loving care, a bit of extra help.
You're advocating that it's time for Australia to move beyond the smoke and you'll die messages, which we still have, really. There's very striking campaigns on at the moment with people saying, oh, I'd rather not have mouth cancer. I knew I'd get emphysema, that kind of thing. What do you suggest that we replace those with?
Well, they still have a role, obviously, but what I'm suggesting is today, in those groups of people who find it difficult, that there is another way, and that is what we would call temporary abstinence or harm minimisation. What if I said to smokers, you could use some of these nicotine products or these tablets temporarily? Is you don't have to quit. You can smoke at home at your leisure, and during the day you could wear a patch or use some of these tablets just temporarily, and then do as you please other times. So it's called, this is harm reduction. It's actually safer to do that. You're obviously smoking less. You'll be inhaling less nicotine. You will be when you're using these products, if you do smoke on top of them. So, for example, if you smoke while you're using these nicotine products, like a patch, for example, and we know at least 25% of people who wear them do that.
Yep.
They actually do that. And it's actually safer to do that than smoke without it. You simply don't inhale as much. You don't draw back as hard. So it's safer.
On Life Matters today, we're talking to Renee Batoon, who's a professor of tobacco, associate professor of tobacco cessation at the University of Sydney, and the first professor of tobacco cessation in the country, about really tackling that hardcore 17-odd% of Australians in 18 to 65 who still smokes, one of the lowest figures in the world, isn't it? Do patches work with everybody? Because I know that drugs don't work with everybody.
Well, I guess we're increasingly seeing that given the right dose and the right medication, it seems that they work with some people very well. If that's the part of the brain where nicotine has been the reinforcer, we're increasingly understanding that some areas of their brain are affected by nicotine in some people and others in other people.
Really?
It's not
the same part of the brain in everybody?
No, it looks like. It's very interesting because one particular medication, for example, there are increasingly newer ones on the market. Mm. There'll be a new one coming in Australia in the next 6 months, I believe. When that happens, don't be disillusioned if there is a listener saying, oh, look, no, I tried that. Try it again, because you just never know your luck. It just might be that medication happens to be the one that targets that part of your brain where nicotine is reinforcing for you. So medications are increasingly really the way we're going. And it does sound strange. I mean, you're taking a pill to help you not smoke. I mean, couldn't be more remotely removed from the behaviour of smoking, you know, yes. Lighting it in the ashtray and the whole ritual. What about all of that? People say that, you know, what about all of that? Well, you'll get people who take these medications and the whole thing evaporates as if it was literally in a puff of smoke. Their urges to smoke simply evaporate.
How do we know who these drugs will be effective with, or is it a matter of suck it and see,
yeah,
as it were?
It is a bit. We don't know how to target people yet, but it's coming, and it's coming in their DNA. There are good tests now, looks like expensive tests to do, where you can test somebody's DNA and say, it looks like you have inherited, so it's heritability, an inherited trait where we might target this part of your brain and not that part. Therefore, this sort of medication will work better than that.
This is called pharmacogenomics, and the idea has been around for, 15 years now, but we're starting to get towards there.
I think we'll be looking at that for smoking.
What is a realistic goal, do you think? Because it occurred to me that, we will never have full employment, but we can have a goal of making it as low as possible. And, you know, at the moment it's 4% or something, depending on how you look at it, less than 5%. Realistically, what can we get that 17% down to?
I think we can get it down to probably at least half of that again. I think that we're concerned with the never smokers. At least there is increasingly now a whole young population of kids who have never smoked, and to just keep on increasing that will be really our major aim, helping people to quit who are older, who are part of that culture, which I was a part of, where smoking was the norm. Now smoking is becoming increasingly not the norm. The normal thing is to be a non-smoker, and it's a fringe activity. And to get down to at least half of 17 would be wonderful. I don't think we'll get to zero. There will probably be a clandestine that is a black market if we made it illegal.
We're not going to do that.
I don't think we should do that, because there are good examples of why not to do that, as we all know. So making it illegal is not an option.
But we could get to 8.5.
Yes, I'm sure we could.
How long do you you think we've been running anti-smoking campaigns seriously now for, 20 or 30 years?
Well, it took 100 years for it to get up that high. So if you think about how tobacco was legalised and advertised and profoundly obviously developed by the tobacco companies, I think it's a realistic goal.
We're doing pretty well.
We're doing very well.
But we need to do better.
We do.
Thank you, Renee. It's been good to see you.
Thank you.
Renee Batoon is Associate Professor of Tobacco Cessation at the University of Sydney. She's the first Professor of Tobacco Cessation in the country and, as far as I know, one of the very few in the world. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National and also Radio Australia, and you can download us and put us on an MP3 player or stream us through your computer. And you do that through abc.net.au/RN. Coming up next, taboo words, why some words still have the power to shock. I still remember the day I realised I had to moderate my language in the car. I'd been trying to cross a particularly busy arterial road. The driver in front of me had dawdled unnecessarily, and I got stuck at the lights. I said a word. It rhymed with mugger. About 3 seconds later, in the clear tones that only come from a 2-year-old boy, we heard it again. My wife and I looked at each other without moving our heads. Kids love so-called naughty words and using them in polite company. They love their shock value. As we get older, there's still a joy in pushing the boundaries, but public language is now so forthright you might wonder where those boundaries are. So many expressions once thought to be unacceptable are part of everyday speech, though other varieties of taboo language have taken their place. Political correctness is a form of taboo, according to the author of a new book on the history of forbidden words. Kate Burridge is a professor of linguistics at Melbourne's Monash University, and with Keith Allen, she's written Forbidden Words, Taboo, and the Censoring of Language. Hello, Kate.
Hello, how are you?
Not too bad at all. What's the richest source of taboo words?
Ooh, the street. Yes, it still is, really, which is why it's hard to get examples, of course, from the past. But yes, it's really a part of fast, furious speech. But of course, that's now becoming more in the public arena, isn't it? And actually written down because of this sort of colloquialisation, I suppose, of language.
Yeah. Slang terms to describe sex and bodily functions, once considered very offensive, and look, some of them still clearly are, yes, are now much more mainstream.
Yes.
Is it inevitable that a new generation of taboo words will take their place?
Well, a couple of things going on here. One is that, of course, words will wear out. It's a sort of fact of lexical life that with time they wear out, and you see this more in swear words and abuse terms. So there's that going on. Of course, you've got to come up with some new, exciting way of saying something. But also, you know, taboos are dynamic and they change sometimes quite dramatically over time. So whereas once, for example, religious-based language was, you know, part of our swearing, that's now changed. So blasphemy, profanity no longer packs much of a punch anymore, and then that was replaced by sexual obscenity, which, again, is worn out, hasn't it? So the real taboos now would be ethnic and racial slurs.
It's interesting that these obviously are all culturally dependent. I remember visiting Quebec years ago, and it's quite a religious society compared to Anglo-Canada even. And so various religious words are part of the swearing jargon, if you like. They're part of it. They were then. Yeah. Le tabernacle was said in conjunction with other ruder words, for example.
Yes, yes, indeed. And you see it, you know, beautifully in English curses like damn you, which would have been once been God damn you. God was, of course, omitted because of euphemistic reasons. And then that gets replaced with ones like, well, screw you or many of the others, readily imagined by your listeners.
I'm sure. Now, the process of a taboo word or phrase becoming part of everyday speech, is that all happening faster because of the modern media, if you like?
It certainly seems faster, and I think it is part of the colloquialisation, liberalisation of language, that you are getting the features of you know, street language now being written down in, you know, of course, e-speak, e-communication is helping that along as well. But also out in the public arena, I mean, you know, if you turn on the television now and you hear words you would never have heard once before. But still, you know, of course, the ethnic and racial slurs, I mean, these are so taboo now as to have legal consequences. The IST language, if you could think of it that way, as my co-author Keith Allen calls it, IST language, racist, sexist, ageist, religionist language. You know, these are the new taboos.
They've become the most taboo of all.
Yes.
Forbidden words are often used as insults. Is that the most common reason that they're created?
Oh, well, it's, you know, taboos are whatever we have trouble with. You know, we're talking about things we'd rather not talk about. And I suppose they make off-the-shelf offensive language dysphemisms, as they're sometimes called, you know, abuse terms and insults, because they pack such a punch. I mean, they are such attention grabbers that, you know, That's why they appear in this sort of language. But they also bubble up, of course, in the scenario you outlined, being cut off in traffic. These words will just bubble up, and of course they are picked up by children who learn the emotional quality of these words very, very early on, before they, of course, have the know-how to suppress them, the sort of social know-how.
Yes, that was very much a kind of penny-dropping moment for me, and I was actually grateful that I hadn't said something else, because I easily could have. I'm much more moderate now.
the kids realise that they come with maximum rewards. Of course, as soon as they utter one, they get all the attention in the world, and they come with punishments too. You know, they might be sent off to their room. So these words actually have, you know, quite a different cultural configuration in the brain. They come with a kind of linguistic health warning, which is why in second language learners, you know, if you learn these words as an adult, they don't have the same emotional component to them.
Right, because they didn't grow up with them. Appreciate them, come on them as a child, as it were.
Quite, yes. They've actually attached fingertip electrodes to, you know, there's one study recently with Turkish-English bilinguals. These words they still raise goosebumps, but nothing like in the first language.
Are these words also, almost therapeutic? The use of them allows us to let off a bit of steam.
There is that. I mean, there are certain advantages to breaking a taboo, pure thrill of transgression, if I put it that way, or indeed the sort of emotional release when you hit your thumb with a hammer or you're cut off in traffic. Most certainly, that's right. It's that sort of cathartic aspect.
One of the interesting things in the book is that you say the brain appears to enjoy hearing taboo language. How do we know that?
There are no laboratory studies that can pinpoint exactly the storage of these words or can evaluate the processing of it. But certainly the linguistic evidence, the evidence that comes from linguistic disorders points to the fact that these words are stored and certainly accessed differently than other vocabulary items. I mean, some people lose all linguistic ability except the ability to produce dirty words. They can swear like a trooper, but when they're called upon to repeat the activity, they can't because they've lost the ability to produce ordinary language. This is sometimes called coprolalia, which is when you're given to outbursts of foul language. It's the emotional type of swearing, such as you described earlier, the being cut off in traffic.
Yeah, and also there's that very small group of people who have that condition, which means that they just swear a little bit every now and again.
That's right.
It's a particular kind of Tourette's.
Yes, it can be a symptom that accompanies Tourette's.
On Life Matters today, our guest is Kate Burridge, who's a professor of linguistics at Monash University in Melbourne and co-author with Keith Allen of Forbidden Words, Taboo and the Censoring of Language. I'm interested in what happens. Taboo isn't just about sex and bodily functions, is it? I mean, we use, and especially in Victoria, the term flake rather than to say that we're eating shark. So words like that help us to smooth over an unpleasant reality.
That's right. For some reason, we have this queasiness about eating shark. As Keith suggested, perhaps it's because they occasionally eat us that we have this unpleasant feeling about shark. The New Zealanders, I gather, call it lemon fish, so it goes under various euphemisms.
Yes.
And of course, there are certain body parts of animals that we don't like to think about. I always like the term fry. It is a kind of omnibus euphemism for, any bit of the animal. It nicely sidesteps the bit that actually gets fried.
I thought that was the liver.
It can be the liver. It can be calves' testicles. It's a kind of all-purpose euphemism, really.
Yes. I'm also actually interesting you mention animals because I can remember when I was very young, you still saw this and you still read it, when there was a particular word for rabbit that's used that it is not used anymore.
That's right. So you do remember the word cunny?
Yes.
Yes, it's the early English word for rabbit, still alive in some dialects, that's right. But, of course, as one lexicographer put it so beautifully, when it took on inappropriate anatomical significance, it disappeared. And that's the extraordinary thing about taboo words. Of course, this one smacked too much like the female bawdy body part, but they will bump off innocent vocabulary items that just happen to sound similar. They're such attention grabbers. I mean, look at the success of designer label FCUK.
Yes.
When we jumble up the letters, these words will just leap out at us.
I can remember when that was called French Connection too, which is what it initially stood for.
Yes, that's right, yes.
But they realised they were onto something much more powerful.
Oh, yes, yes.
And people lampoon political correctness, but is this a quote-unquote nice form of taboo, the intention to use language to soften rather than offend?
Yes, that's right. Indeed. It's the desire to come up with a label, the name that people want to be called, but of course that is so fraught since it does change. There's no one size fits all, isn't there? So the recent ruling in the States against nigger, it's very, very difficult to legislate against words that wound because of this fact. I mean, it depends entirely on context, and that word in the mouths of those that have natural cover, if I put it that way, is a very positive term. Of course, in the mouths of outsiders, it's highly offensive.
Yes, it's so context dependent, this stuff, isn't it?
It is. There's no one man's euphemism or one man's dysphemism, to use the opposite of euphemism. It's entirely context driven.
Now, there is a kind of backlash against politically correct language. Is that pretty consistent with the Australian tradition of calling a spade a spade?
Well, it's this feeling, I suppose, that people get that words are kind of hijacked. They can't use words like they used to use them. I think what political correctness has done is it has created this climate of censorship, tacit censorship, so you don't dare to use these words because if you were to use them, then you're lumped together with others that use them, and that could include real bigots or, misogynists or whatever. So the safest course to travel is to use the PC term, and people get upset, don't they, by this feeling that these words are taken away from them.
Yes, people get upset about things that you would think are minor, like calling somebody a chairperson or chair rather than chairman.
That's right. It's very, very difficult.
It's easier just to say you, I think, in this context.
Yeah,
Can we look at the word gay as an example?
Yes.
Because I think gay is now on its third meaning, is that right?
Oh, it's always been very slippery, this word. If you go back far enough in time, it probably goes back to word meaning impetuous or swift. If you go back to old High German times, this word has always had a multitude of meanings. But since the 1300s, it's certainly been dripping with sexual innuendo. I don't think people realise that they have this idea that it has always meant, you know, merry and bright. But it was, even in Chaucer's time, you know, what did Chaucer mean when he said some gay girls? It clearly wasn't an innocent little vocabulary item, and it quickly in the 1600s came to mean prostitute. It was used quite negatively of women, and then dictionaries will give quite a late meaning for or late entries for the meaning of homosexual, 1920s, but I think there are quotes around in the 1800s that show that that meaning was around then. But these words will not stand still. You know, we get this idea that words are these nice little tight packages of form and meaning. You know, we look up the real meaning of a word in a dictionary, but of course they're incredibly slippery things, and teenagers use gay very differently now.
Yeah, they do. Now, finally, would you say we're becoming less polite, that we use taboo language more freely?
Well, in Australia and certainly in Britain as well, there's always been this upside-down use of slang too, isn't there? Or abuse terms, you know, the g'day old bastard kind of.
That's right.
So the more you like someone, the more you can use these sorts of terms.
That's right. It's a tradition, isn't it? The closer you are someone, the more you insult them gratuitously.
Exactly. And, of course, it's always been a part of steamy pillow talk, if I put it that way. And, so it's, again, this old problem of these words not being intrinsically nasty. They can have quite positive uses depending on who's using it and to whom.
Kate, it's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Kate Barrage is a professor of linguistics at Melbourne's Monash University, and with Keith Allen, she's written Forbidden Words, Taboo and the Censoring of Language, which is published by Cambridge University Press. Coming up next on Life Matters, a special appeal to rebuild homes for East Timor's nurses.
Romulus, My Father, is a story of impossible love.
The time you enjoy wasting is not wasted time.
Based on Raymond Gaita's critically acclaimed memoir about growing up with his Yugoslav father in country Australia.
The summer days were lazy. We wore only shorts and mostly went barefoot.
Romulus, My Father, the CD soundtrack and audiobook are now available at ABC shops, centres and online.
Now to East Timor. In last year's unrest, 82 nurses in the Dili area had their homes burned down or vandalised. Their houses were targeted because they were empty during the emergency, most nurses who were working. More than a year on, the situation that Dili's nurses find themselves in is desperate. They're living in one-room tents without electricity, running water or proper sanitation. The Australian Nurses Federation has a close relationship with the East Timor Nurses Union and is now holding an appeal together with Union Aid Abroad. The aim is to raise money to build homes for the nurses. Today we're joined on the phone by Madeleine Hanjin from Dili. She's one of the nurses who's in this situation. And in our Melbourne studio we have Jed Carney, the Assistant Federal Secretary of the Nurses Australian Nurses Federation. Madeleine, I want to begin with you. Can you tell me where you and the other nurses are living now?
Some of our nurses are taken back to the family, but still they are living together with the families. But some are still living in a tent, in a camp, refugee camp. This is about 82 nurses. But by the time also the violence still increasing by the time, and then the number is still, you know, increased by 2-3 nurses that they still live in their property, and then they have to move into the district areas.
How many?
Up to this moment, we got the information about 87 nurses that now have a problem with their properties that are banned by the violence.
Right, and these tents that you're in, they're in the grounds of Dili Hospital, is that right?
Yes, some in the ground of Dili Hospital and some within the IDPs that living close by the hospital. Like we have some IDP camps like in a monument, some monument of some park in the district in the Dili district.
Mm.
So some they live in the hospital, some living outside of the hospital, but they still live in a tent.
How many times has your home been destroyed?
Myself, I got like three times since, you know, when I lived with my parents in 1975 and then 1999, and also this crisis about last year.
So in 75 and then in 99
yes.
and then in 2006.
Yes, 2006.
Who do you blame for destroying your home last year?
This last year, it seems that the things is coming from the internal problems of the government, and then from the some fundamental problems, and then it seems that affect to the ethnic group, and then this ethnic group is come some of us in, like come from this ethnic group, and then this, that's why people started you know hate the people from West Park, people uh-huh. from West Park. They like discriminate people from the east part, and they started, you know, pursue it and bomb the houses. And then some of us, like 87 nurses, we are come from the east part. This this our we are attacked by the people from east. But the thing is from the fundamental problem from the government. Something happened within the government, and then affect to the ethnic group. And then nurses also, some of the nurses that from the east part. Suffer from this consequence.
Well, I want to bring in Jed Carney at this stage. Jed, so many people are destitute in East Timor. Why is it particularly important to help the nurses?
Well, at times like this when people are homeless, of course, health is of paramount importance, as you could imagine. Low sanitation, poor hygiene, people living in tents with no running water, no proper hygiene facilities. I think you need healthcare workers to actually care for the people when they do become ill or to maintain hygiene standards and prevent illness. So the nurses are a really critical part of the infrastructure in East Timor, and we would really like to help the nurses actually re-establish their homes. Number one, so that they're not exhausted. What we find the nurses are telling us, they're living on the grounds of the hospital and so they are constantly on call. They're working 24 hours, really. They don't get proper rests. They themselves don't have proper living conditions, so we don't want them to get sick as well. It's healthcare workers, as you could imagine, are a vital part of the infrastructure during times like this.
I have read that some of them have been ill because of this. Some, at least one nurse has got malaria. Area because of sleeping outside.
Oh, definitely. I'm sure there's more than one. We are very concerned about the health of the nurses, and that's why we think it's a priority to get them proper living facilities so that they can help rebuild East Timor now.
What sort of contact has there been between the Australian and East Timorese nurses then?
We've got a very long history with the nurses of East Timor. Back in 1999, after Indonesia left, we were contacted by our colleagues in East Timor who said they wanted to re-establish the Nursing Federation and or the Nursing Association over there. And through the generosity of the Queensland branch of the Australian Nursing Federation, they held their first meeting and set priorities about what the what an association would do. After the after independence, there was no records of registration of nurses. There were no schools for nurses. We had students that were halfway through their training who couldn't complete. And as you know, the whole country was in turmoil. So we assisted, the ANF assisted the association to reform. We assisted them with establishing an office and funded an office, a car. We provided a car. And we've since worked with them over the last 6 or 7 years to re-establish a nursing registration system. The East Timor Nurses Association have very proudly been part of re-establishing a nursing academy. They've been negotiating the return of nurses from refugee camps in West Timor because a lot of nurses, as you could imagine, fled the Troubles. And they've been lobbying the government to have nurses employed, to create more jobs for nurses in Dili and the surrounding districts.
On Life Matters today, we're talking about the plight of nurses in East Timor. Our guests, Jed Carney, who's Assistant Federal Secretary of the Australian Nurses Federation, and also Madalena Hanjan, who is a nurse in East Timor. Madalena, there are reports that nurses are bringing their families with them to the hospital in the hope that the hospital can provide them with food.
I think we are a lot of nurses that evacuate to the hospital at the time, but the hospital only provided food only for the nurses who were, but not to, to the whole families. And then association have to work hard with this, and then I do deal with the international agencies, for example, WFP and then government and MTRC. How can they help also not only for the nurses, but the nurses' families? And then after this, the nurses can also receive the rice, you know, beans, oil, to support them up to this moment. But for this moment, they are getting a little bit support about food, but the living condition is still really poor. Mm. And then now you can see a lot, you know, start the raining season, they have to, you know, sleep in their tents, and then they have to work hard in the next day, 24 hours. So this is a really big problem for us.
Mm.
And then the government is trying hard to move them to some, you know, area.
What?
But still, we still consider it still not safety for them.
What?
I would like to keep them still in the same place, and then by the time we see if we can do something.
What kind of help have you been getting from the Australian Nurses Federation?
This is huge support. they do give us, you know, it seems that moral support. They do give us, you know, support about the some funding to our staff that we're trying to work in hard to visit the nurses, and then also we just try to provide some, you know, support, like, you know, if they're sick, we can, you know, give them support and something related to the basic needs. And then for shelter, also we try, if the nurses that, you know, have living with their poor condition, no mattress, no blankets, the association cooperate with INF to support them in a really simple and then condition, just to improve their living condition in their tent. But we'll see what happens later.
All right.
Still, a big problem for us.
Jed Carney, if I come back to you, I understand you've actually been really impressed by how cheerful the East Timorese nurses are, given their situation.
We're absolutely amazed. Yeah. They are really wonderful, wonderful people. I haven't been to East Timor, but a number of my colleagues have, and they come back each time and say, despite the living conditions, despite the hardship, despite their incredible losses time and time again, they remain very positive. They're very grateful for any assistance that's provided to them, and they make the absolute most of every minute that we, every bit of help that we can give them.
I understand that the goal is to build about 80 homes.
Yes.
How far towards that goal are you?
Well, unfortunately, we've got enough money to build about 17 homes only, so we're falling pretty well short of our target.
63 to go.
Yes, 63 to go. We've got a little bit less than $100,000 at the moment in the fund. So we're really appealing to all our members, to all nurses, friends of nurses, anybody really that would like to help us with the appeal. We would like to raise $400,000. It will all be managed through Union Aid Abroad, which AFIDA, who is the aid arm who's helping us distribute the funds.
How can people who are listening now donate to the East Timor Nurses Appeal?
They can go to our website, which is www.anf.org.au, and click on the $5 plus appeal. We're asking everybody to give $5 or more, and there's several ways there to donate, or they can actually send a check to Union Aid Abroad, Nurses Appeal, Level 1, 365 Queen Street, Melbourne, 3000. And if they provide their name and address, we will ensure they get a receipt, and it's fully tax deductible. And we're nearly at the end of the financial year, so it's a good time to do it.
Well, we'll also put a link on our website for anyone who'd like to make a donation. Madalena, I hope you're out of a tent soon and back into a house where you belong. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you. And thank you for Australia.
And Jed, thanks to you too.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Jed Carney, the Assistant Federal Secretary of the Australian Nurses Federation. We also heard from Madalena Hanjan, who, as you heard, is one of 80-odd nurses, still essentially living in tents, mostly in the grounds of the hospital in Dili, more than a year
after nurses' homes were destroyed, largely because they were unoccupied during the emergency because the nurses were all working. And the Australian Nurses Federation is trying to raise $400,000 to rebuild the homes for the nurses. And I think you'd agree, it's a really good cause. We will link, as I said, from our website, which is abc.net.au/rn. If you go there, you'll be able to click on a link that will take you to somewhere where you can make a donation. And now we should find out what's coming up next on ABC Radio National. It's The Book Show with Ramona Koval, and Ramona's here to tell us what she's got.
Richard, look, I don't know if you remember Xinran Shui, who was a Chinese author and journalist who ran a radio show in mainland China, and a lot of Chinese women rang up and talked to her about her stories, especially
That's right.
rural women. Remember her? She wrote The Good Women of China. She's back with her new book, and it's called Miss Chopsticks, and we'll be hearing all about more rural women's stories as well this morning.
Join Ramona after the news, which is coming up in a moment, for an interview with Xinran Shui. Tomorrow on Life Matters, 25 years of research into rainbow families, more than two decades on little difference has shown up, on how little difference has shown up between those raised in gay and lesbian families and those with parents of a different sex. And a special Meet the Listener guest tomorrow, who's on a 6,000-kilometre journey for peace. I'm Richard Adey. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.